Morning. And good morning. Can you guys hear me back there? Good. Okay. So this morning, last time I talked, which was 2 weeks ago, I talked about the first paragraph in the Genjo Koan by Dogen. And a couple of you came up to me afterwards and said you'd like me to talk more about dharmas. So I thought, oh, that'll be fun. So I'm going to talk about dharmas today. Let's see, where shall I start? So dharmas. I'm talking about dharmas in the sense that Dogen uses it when he says all dharmas, all small d dharmas, are the Buddha Dharma. So I'm going to talk most of the time about small d dharmas. In early Buddhism, meditators developed a way of talking about meditative experience that was very deep, was very still. And they talked about it as bringing the dharmas into view. The idea being that usually we don't bring the dharmas into view. Usually we are just in our concepts. We are just in our planning and our remembering and our comparing and our feeling frustrated and our feeling elated. We do not bring the dharmas into view, and the dharmas are the atoms of experience that make up our world from moment to moment. And a dharma lasts that long? What do they say? I can't remember what they say. A 60th of a second? A 100th of a second? I don't know. Different. I don't know how they did this timing of it back in those days. They had a stopwatch. A dharma lasts this long, and there are a multiplicity of them. And usually they're overlaid by our conceptual framework and our own needs to make our concepts work for us, so we have a world that we can hold together and that we can get along okay in, that we can control. And in morning study group a while ago, I mentioned the work of B.L. Whorf, Benjamin Whorf. This work, though, is work from 40 years ago, when I first started studying this stuff. And B.L. Whorf was a linguist, and his work 40 years ago was to compare conceptual sets with actual experiences and look at how the concepts filtered through the immediate awareness. And he did a study which was controversial and I think has been critiqued and no longer considered valid. But anyway, it's I still have a point. The study was of perception of snow by English-speaking people and perception of snow by some far northern Alaska, Eskimo, northern Canada, I don't know, tribe, in which we had one word for snow and they had like a dozen words for snow, and that our filter was much cruder, so that we just saw the one, and their filter was in regard to snow more refined, so they saw the 15. Now that's controversial, but the point is that we have these filters that filter out our immediate experience because we want to survive. We want to have a life, and that's how we, our culture. But in meditation, there's a chance to come back to some unfiltered experience. And so there are many, many types of dharmas, and they list dharmas, which actually seems ridiculous, but they think they had something to do better to do than that, but after all, they're just spending their whole life meditating, so maybe they don't have anything better to do. They list dharmas. A dharma, for example, let's see. If I'm looking at that bell there on the floor, And maybe David is looking at that bell. He's going to see a different Dharma than I do. I'm going to see a form there, and that's an experiential moment when I just see that before I label it. I just see it. But he's going to see it differently. So that when we say dharmas are atoms of experience, they have no objective reality. There's no objective reality in Buddhism. There's no objective reality anyway. You don't need Buddhism. it's an experiential moment. So each of us looks at that bell, although some of you can't even see it, and you see it differently. And then you immediately do conceptual overlay. And so the idea is to bring the dharmas into view as much as possible. And one way that the dharmas are divided up, a really common way, which I've talked about before, is through the aggregates, through the skandhas. That ego, self, is a fabrication, and it's made up of the skandhas, made up of the aggregates, which are form, sensation, perception, emotional impulse or mental tendency, and consciousness. And so the dharmas are then categorized in those five different parts of what we call self. So the first categorization is form, and those are the sensory dharmas. Those are that's our sight, smell, sound, taste, touch. Those dharmas are the sensory dharmas. And then, from the sensory dharmas, we move on to the sensation dharmas. There are three: positive, negative, and neutral. In relation to my sensory experience, I either like it, I hate it, or I could care less about it. The third, then I have a perception that comes out of that. The fourth, I have an emotional response. It could be a neutral emotional response if I'm totally uninterested, but more likely it's positive or negative emotional response. And fifth, there's consciousness. Consciousness is the self-talk that I do about the first four. The problem, of course, from our point of view, us Buddhists, is that people get fixated on the last one, which is only a single dharma, that is consciousness. Consciousness is only one dharma, and yet consciousness, with its subconscious gossiping and its very conscious kind of planning and comparing, takes over and doesn't allow us to see the array of dharmas, to see that each of those dharmas is the Buddha Dharma, is life. So, in the morning, I make rounds at the altars, and I make a round, I bow at each of the candles. We have a little altar in our kitchen with a candle, and I bow there. So let's go through them. So I come down. It's early morning. I see the candle, and let's just pretend that I see a bunch of stuff under the candle, a peanut butter jar, and a bunch of paper towels that are crumpled up. So I see the candle instead of my usual Dharma experience. My sensation is negative. I have a negative sensation. Negative sensation when I see the candle and all that crud. And then from the negative sensation, I have a perception, which is crud under candle. It's just a perception, a quick perception. Don't even verbalize it. And then I have a mental tendency or an emotional impulse, which is annoyed, right? And then consciousness takes off. Consciousness takes off. This is the problem with human beings, is that consciousness takes off. And it says, Why did they do that? Who did that? How many more times are they going to do that? Who do I have to tell about that? Don't they have any sense about what this is all about? Da 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 da. You know, right? So that's the way we usually are. Of course, through practice, it's possible to see this stuff and then to not have consciousness take off. To have consciousness just say, oh, speak to someone, and then speak to someone. And then it's all just fine. No big deal. No big deal. But because we've got this ego investment in my Zen center, my kitchen, my role as Tenzo or Eno or teacher or you know, whatever, assistant teacher, then we take off and we create worlds and worlds and worlds. And then we're caught by those worlds and worlds and worlds. We're trapped by those worlds and worlds and worlds. They've totally been our own creation. So I was told during this last retreat that I should tell grandfather stories. So I got two grandfather stories to tell. Because I have a grandson who's two. So yesterday, my daughter called, and my grandson lives in France with my daughter and my son-in-law. And my daughter called and said, "Would you like to talk to Ethan on the phone?" And I said, "Oh, sure, I'd love to." So I talked to Ethan on the phone, and Ethan can talk back. He knows how to talk. You know, his vocabulary is very limited, but he talks, and he likes to talk. Well, I talked to him, but he didn't talk back. And I talked to him, and he didn't talk back. And I kept saying to Erin, "Where is he?" She said, "Oh, he's listening. Oh, he's listening." But he didn't say a word. He didn't talk back. And that's in contrast to when I had talked to him, I don't know, 3 weeks ago or 4 weeks ago, and we had Skyped, right? Anybody who doesn't know about Skyping? Oh, well, I had my first Skyping experience with Ethan just five weeks ago, where he got on the screen, I got on the screen, and we hung out together. We talked and hung out. Wow. And so anyway, when we Skype, he talks right back to me. He talks right back to me. But his fifth skanda has not developed enough, its abstract sense, so that he realizes that he can talk back when I'm just on the phone. He just hears this voice coming out of the phone. There's someone to talk to. I mean, he's listening. But he hasn't developed his vijnana yet, his consciousness at a sophisticated enough level. And of course he will, and that's great. But then after a while, it's going to take over his whole world. And that's, for me, is the sad part. I feel sad about that. But I know that at some point, maybe in his, when he gets to be 20 and he has a good solid ego, maybe he'll do a little meditating. But he probably won't. My kids never listened to me. Why would my grandson? So we have this wonderful gift of consciousness, the ability to dream, to plan, to think, to create worlds, to do wonderful artistic, intellectual things. But then we abuse it. And we forget the dharmas, the immediacy of everything, except that one dharma. So we have practices in Zen, then, to bring the dharmas into view. We have practices. I'm going to talk about three, and for those of you who have been with me for a while, these are not new. Three practices. So the first practice is bringing the physical dharmas into view. So the physical dharmas is the first aggregate, the aggregate of form, the aggregate of physicality. And if you can bring those into view, if you can focus on bringing those into view, you can slow the process down. You can slow the process of the fourth and the fifth getting out of control, of the emotional impulse feeding into the consciousness, feeding back to the emotional impulse, so that they both just take over everything. So physical, 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 physical. In Zen, we posture. Why do we sit straight? To come back to the physical dharma. And that will slow down, at some point, the frenetic activity of the last two dharmas. It's frenetic, isn't it? It's frenetic. It's absurd. It's absurd. But everybody does it, so maybe it's not absurd. To me, it seems absurd. So to slow those down by my posture while I'm sitting, by paying attention to my breathing, by paying attention to how I hold my hands. Of course, we're supposed to do it in this cosmic mudra, but other ways are okay, providing you're paying attention, providing you're using it to come back. And then also outside, not just when you're sitting, but outside. What are your opportunities to be with your sights, your sounds, your smells, your tastes, your touches, just to be with them? When you're driving in the car. I spend almost as much time driving in the car as I do sitting here at Zen Center, unfortunately. And more every year because of our highways are getting more clogged up. I spend twice as much time in the car as I did 12 years ago because the freeways have gotten that much worse. So here is an opportunity for me to be in the physicality of the primary skanda, the rupa skanda. Sometimes I listen to the radio, that's fine, but then I'm just listening to the radio. But when I'm not, then I can really focus on my hands on the steering wheel, my body in the seat, my breathing, just like I'm in the Zendo. It's a little harder because there are cars all around me, but it's an opportunity. I consider it an opportunity. So that's the first practice. The second practice has to do with the fourth skanda. The fourth skanda is the emotional impulse skanda, is the mental tendency skanda. And that skanda has the mental dharmas in it. The dharmas are often divided into physical dharmas and mental dharmas. So the mental dharmas, all of our fear, happiness, anger, bliss, anxiety, those are all the mental dharmas. And they're also just like this. They come so quickly. And they can go that quickly, but because you feed them with your consciousness, you can hang around with them for hours, days, weeks, even years. My goodness. What you human beings are up to. What we human beings are up to. So bringing the mental dharmas into view, then, is another practice. But when we bring the mental dharmas into view, the second practice, we bring the wholesome mental dharmas into view. Because the dharmas are furtherly divided into wholesome and unwholesome, the mental dharmas. And the wholesome mental dharmas, or the positive mental dharmas, encourage us in this practice. They help us with our inspiration when we lose it. They help us when we get discouraged about the sitting isn't getting anywhere. Shouldn't I try another religion or another practice that would get me, have more results? Or seem like it was at least worth my time? When you get discouraged like that, and you will. If you're serious about meditation, you will. Because meditation is not one of the easiest things you're going to do in your life. I don't know where it rates in difficulty, but I'm afraid it's not toward the easy end of the continuum for anyone. It's not. It's not. So you need encouragement. You need positive mental dharmas called wholesome dharmas. And you need to bring them into view. So that's the second practice, is to bring wholesome dharmas, wholesome mental dharmas into view. And there's so many examples of wholesome mental dharmas. One would be the paramitas. Those are wholesome mental dharmas. Giving, morality, patience, effort, meditation, wisdom. Those are wholesome mental dharmas. And the unwholesome were their opposites. Grasping, immorality, impatience. lack of meditation, and then there's no wisdom. I left out effort. Slothfulness. Slothfulness. So bringing the wholesome dharmas into view, is there's all kind of practices to do that. And one of the practices, the second wholesome dharma, is the wholesome dharma shila, which is morality. And we have the precepts. The precepts. And when I initiate people into this sangha, not this sangha, but this sangha, right? This huge universe of dharmas. When I initiate people, I give them the precepts. I give them the precepts. So it's not that I'm giving them to them. It's that I'm encouraging them to practice some wholesome dharmas, some wholesome ways of being in the world. And they recite those ways of being moral, those ways of being ethical, those ways of feeling good about what you're doing and reaching out to people and feeling connected to them. So I do that in both the initiation ceremony and the ordination ceremony. Then mantras also that's wholesome dharma cultivation with mantras. Now, we don't use mantras too much in Zen, but lots of Buddhists may use mantras a lot. And I've used two mantras in my life, only two. Both of them were given to me by teachers. And the first is Om Klim Buddhaya Namaha. And that means I bow down to compassionate Buddha. So that's a little bit. So that's one mantra that I've used. The second mantra that I've used is Gyate, Gyate, Para Gyate, Parasam Gyate. Now, many of you should be familiar with that one by now. Gone, gone, gone beyond, gone completely beyond. So the first mantra is more devotional. Is more devotional. It's more. It's good to use that first kind of mantra in a situation where you just need to humble yourself. You just need and want to give yourself away and become very, very tiny. Return to being so tiny that everybody else is big, and that's great because there's no distinction. So that's Om Klim Buddhaya Namaha. I bow down before compassionate Buddha. But then you could get attached to that one. Sometimes you just need a sharp, sharp one that punctures all devotion or non-devotion or belief in anything or non-belief in anything. So that's the Gyate Gyate one. And when my teacher gave it to me, I said to him, should I say the whole thing? Gyate Gyate Para Gyate Parasam Gyate, or should I just say Gyate? He said, oh, say the whole thing, but they're all the same. So he just punctured my attachment to some special mantra. So that's why we don't do mantras too much here, because you think you've got the mystical mantra. Your teacher gave you the mystical mantra. Oh, then your expectation becomes wonderful for a while, right? And you get very high for a while, right? Until something happens. So... But mantras are still good. Just take them with a grain of salt. Please. It can be very helpful. I use them in times of... If I'm in a lot of physical pain, and I have to sit here in front of everybody, you know. Well, of course, they don't see me, but because I sit facing them, everybody else sits facing the wall, but they could see me. I'm in awful pain. I think, oh, I can't move. They're not moving. So then I better, gyate, gyate, para gyate, gyate, gyate. And it's great. It's cool. But don't take this to an extreme. Sometimes just move. And then you can say gyate, gyate, because you're gone is your idea of any dualism between movement or non-movement, right? And it's really gone. And a loving kindness meditations. Those are all positive. That's always all positive, wholesome dharma cultivation. for those of you who do meditation or have done it. Loving kindness. And Robert Aiken, if you read Robert Aiken, Aiken Roshi from Hawaii, he uses gathas, which he seems to have written himself, for like going to the bathroom and brushing your teeth, and they're kind of light. And I tried to see if they came from anything traditional, but I couldn't see them, so I think he just wrote them himself. They're very beautiful. They're very helpful. And Thich Nhat Hanh also suggests different gathas to help to coordinate with your sitting. So you deep on the in-breath, peace on the out-breath. He has a whole series he suggests. But this is all cultivating the wholesome dharmas. Because we tend to get discouraged. We tend to not believe we can do this practice. We tend to think we don't have the skill. We're too anxious. We're too depressed. You don't feel that way at first, but just sit for a couple of days with me and see how you feel. I don't mean to scare you off. Sorry. Maybe you'll have a wonderful experience. You could. So those two first practices together in ancient Buddhism are referred to as shamatha, right? S-A-M-A-T-H-A, shamatha practices. Practices of peace, practices of calmness. You're cultivating peace, you're cultivating calmness. The peace and the calmness that you really need to bring all the dharmas into view. And to realize that all the dharmas are the Buddha Dharma. And then the third practice is the practice of shikantaza, the practice of bare attention, the practice of not discriminating between good dharmas and bad dharmas, physical dharmas and mental dharmas, just each dharma. You just let it come in and you touch it. And then you let it go. You don't grab it. You just lightly touch it. And it goes. If you lightly touch it, it goes. Lightly touch it. It goes. Always. But usually we grab it or we fight with it or we get consciousness involved immediately in analyzing it or projecting it on something. So this third practice, shikantaza, dogen, just to sit, right? That means just to sit. Bare attention. It's not mindfulness. I've talked about that before. Mindfulness, we're trying to do something. We're trying to be mindful. Yes, I should be more mindful. I should pay attention that my glass is here and my glasses are on my head and not get my glass and my glasses mixed up with each other or something. That's mindful. That's good. But this is bare attention. This is not worrying about being mindful. You don't have to worry about being mindful. You're just with it. You're just with that dharma. Even if it's an angry dharma, you're just with it. You touch it and it goes. It goes. And so that's called, in ancient Buddhism, the practice of vipassana. And I know we have a lot of vipassana Buddhism here in this country, but it comes from that ancient practice, which really means just to insight, just to see into. That's what the word etymologically means, seeing into. So you touch it, you see it, and it goes. And shamatha and vipassana go together. But shamatha is considered necessary to really do vipassana, to really do touch and go. So we had this retreat here last week with Tenshin Roshi, Reb Anderson, and this place was full, and it was wonderful. And during the question and answer time, he had people come up to him and sit there in that space on their cushions, who wanted to, and ask him questions or make statements. And at one point, a woman came up who, I think she was Chinese. She could have been a Korean. Pardon? Korean? Oh, it was Korean. And she said she started talking in broken English about what she was trying to do and how she had never done it, never come up and talked like this before, and then how she was embarrassed by her English. And Reb said, kind of, Reb Tenshin Roshi said, well, good, meaning good, you're showing that dharma of embarrassment. You're just able to be here with it in front of others. Be here with it, and then you can let it go. He didn't say that to her, but she was present enough that she was able to do it, and then just let it go. Just touch and go. She did that in the intensity of a retreat. And sometimes in the intensity of a retreat, we're able to do these things that we aren't able to do in our daily lives because we've been doing a lot of concentration. So another story about my grandson, which I told already, I think, in morning study group. So we were getting ready to go on the plane, and my grandson was going to come with me and my wife on the plane, and my daughter was not going with us. She was going on a different plane. So my daughter, the day before we were going, we're leaving in the morning, was saying to Ethan, Grandma, Grandpa plane. She said it over and over, you know, a lot of times. Grandma, Grandpa plane, no Mama plane. Grandma, Grandpa plane, no Mama plane. She said, well, it's going to help him if I repeat this to him. It's going to help him. So I thought, well, that's neat. Let's see if it helps him. And so the next morning, just before we were getting ready to leave, well, no, actually, when we just awakened, before we even got dressed, I went into his room. And he was lying, and he had his plane with him. He carries his planes and cars around with him wherever he goes. He's got to do that. He had his little plane with him, and he was saying to himself, Mama, Grandma, baby plane. Oh, no, he wasn't saying Mama. He was saying Grandma, Grandpa, baby plane, Mama plane. Grandma, Grandpa, baby plane, no Mama plane. So what was he doing? He was doing wholesome dharma work. He had his wholesome dharma, his wholesome that he was cultivating, and that was pretty cool. And I went through the list of wholesome dharmas that's in one of the Abhidharma texts, and I said, well, which of these dharmas was he doing? Oh, faith. He was cultivating faith, because this was a scary going on about Mama, and this was a way of cultivating his faith. So that's an example, again, of the second practice. I should have talked about that before I talked about the third practice. The third practice, anyway, is the Shikantaza, is the bare attention practice, which results in, at some point, radical acceptance of just what is, which isn't Stoicism, because Stoicism is something heady. This is not that. It's actually seeing, as I've said before, that each wave, regardless of its undertow, is just what it is, regardless of whether it's got man-o-war jellyfish in it or not. It's just what it is, and it's a manifestation of the ocean itself, like it or not. Like it or not. And it's, I think, difficult to manifest the third one, to know the third one, to be able to really do the third one without depending on the first two sometimes. So we're coming back now to the statement itself, which I talked about last time. All dharmas are the Buddha Dharma. So that's small. All small d dharmas are the big d dharma. The different use of the word dharma. Each of these little experiences is ultimate reality because it's what is. It's what is. And there's a teaching in that, in each one. And when I talked about this last time, Cindy said, yeah, there's a teaching in that, but people who are depressed in particular don't realize that there's a teaching in that until much later. And I said, well, that's true for everybody. And it is true for everybody. It is true for everybody. But with practice, it becomes less and less true. More and more we're able just to see the Dharma of annoyance at the altar. Well, there it is. There it is. And just say, oh, you know, will you clean that up? And then just let it go. Let it go. And there's some teaching in there, too. But it takes practice. So Dogen talks about this practice of all dharmas being the Buddha Dharma as swimming on the surface of the ocean while your feet touch the bottom. And so the emphasis in this practice is on the practice, not the I am practicing, but the am practicing. The am practicing. At some point, the energy from the I moves into the am practicing. It moves into it, and the I loses its energy because it doesn't need it. You don't need that. You don't need that energy because there's the am being, am engaging, am breathing, am looking. You don't need that. It loses its energy and gives its energy over to the immediacy of the dharmas. And when that happens, one of the Buddhist scriptures talks about that as the death of the lion. The death of the lion. When I think about the death of the lion, it's not really explained in this Buddhist scripture. To me, it seems like the death of Narcissus. The death of the body of fear that we're fixated on. That the fifth consciousness fixates on. That's why the fifth consciousness takes over and runs everything. And doesn't pay attention to the immediacy because of fear. And narcissism of fear, and I'm not using this I'm not using this in a diagnostic sense. I'm using this in a sense of what we all experience now. But the death of the lion will happen and does happen. But then if you get excited about the death of the lion, you created a new lion that's excited about the death of the lion. Right? So that's why the practice of bare attention is a practice of the worms eating the lion's corpse. This comes out of the scripture. That's the practice of bare attention. The worms eating the lion's corpse. And if you do this practice and you allow the worms to eat your corpse, then you're a Dharma heir. Then you're an heir to this Dharma, to this great tradition that started we don't know when. We just made it all up. And we'll end we don't know when. We're just making it all up. But it resonates with everything. There's a resonation, a joy and a gladness with everyone that just wells up. Wells up. And it comes from nowhere in particular. Just the ocean. Just the ocean. And then you're a Dharma heir. And you don't need any lineage papers or go through any ceremonies or anything. You are a Dharma heir. But then if you think you're a Dharma heir, I'm going to give you a can of worms. I'm the Dharma heir around here. And you need some worms. And that's how we have maintained our lineage. That's how we maintain it. That's a little weird. We were talking about this in morning study group. It's a little weird. Not in too many religions do they have this transmission Dharma heir stuff. Don't pay attention to the outside of it. Do it inside. If you do it inside, you don't even need the outside. Because the body of fear, the body of Narcissus, will drop away. Drop away at any time. At any time. through these three practices. But if you think you're beyond doing one of the practices, just shikantaza, I don't think so. You're never beyond. Okay, I think that's enough. Questions, comments? Oh, she's asking whether you know. Do you want to? Yeah, you have to explain that. You'd have to explain that. If you want to explain that, we can talk about it. That's right.
So, I was just wondering.
You could say that. So, what she's talking about is that we have a dilemma as human beings about life and death. We all have that, about getting what we want in this world, about loving and getting our love back that we want. And Zen practice with a teacher sort of magnifies that problem. I mean, so that we can bring that problem to a head, if we bring it to a head through our concentration, through our practice on the three practices that I talked about, we can then see that problem is just a corpse. It's just a corpse. But we have to really see the intensity of the lion first before it will die. The intensity of our difficult situation in our life. If you don't have some sense of the difficulty of your situation, you won't practice. And you won't encounter the lion, and you won't then let the worms devour the lion's corpse. So I would not say that the worms per se were a way of expanding the problem, but the practice itself of sitting every day, if you sit seriously, expands the problem because you're just sitting facing a wall and you have nothing else, and doing retreats, it expands the problem. So it brings you back to your just fundamental issue of who are you and what are you doing here, so that you can break through it and come back to your original acknowledgement that each wave is the whole ocean. Okay.